The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Case 51 from the Blue Cliff Record. The introduction. As soon as there is affirmation and negation, you lose your mind in a flurry. But without descent into stages, there is no way of seeking. So tell me, is it right to let go, or is it right to hold still? Here the slightest interpretation is still stuck in verbal explanation. If you still get involved in devices and objects, all of it is dependency. Even if you immediately arrive at a state of independent liberation, you are still 10,000 miles away. Can you get there? If not for the moment, just understand this koan at hand. When Xuefeng was living in a hut, two monks came to pay respects. Seeing them coming, Xuefeng pushed open the door of the hut, popped out, and said, "What is it?" A monk also said, "What is it?" Xuefeng hung his head and went back inside. The monk later went to Yantou. Yantou asked, "Where have you come from?" The monk said, "South of the range." Yantou asked, "Did you ever go to Xuefeng?" The monk said, "Yes." Yantou said, "What did he have to say?" The monk recited the foregoing story. Yantou asked, "What did he say?" The monk said, "He said nothing. He hung his head and went back inside." Yantou said, "Ah, too bad I didn't tell him the last word. Had I told him, no one could do anything to Xuefeng." At the end of the summer, the monk brought up the story again and asked for more help. Yantou said, "Why didn't you ask before?" The monk said, "I didn't dare be casual." Yantou said, "Though Xuefeng is born of the same lineage as me, he does not die in the same lineage as me. If you want to know the last word, it is just this." So early this morning, the moon was high in the clear sky, shining brightly. Now clouds cover the sky. Here we are, deep in our sesshin, deep in our training period. This way of awakening, this path of awakening, is wonderful and mysterious. Sometimes we say it is utterly reliable. But the reliability of this path is not that it will do, it will take you where you think you want to go. The two monks went to visit Xuefeng. Xuefeng, who at one time had a monastery of 1,500 students, and then times changed. And he went into the mountains and lived by himself. But occasionally had visitors. Occasionally monks like these would come. And such a wonderful description. He popped out of his hut. Some excitement to see these seekers of the way. Maybe these were students that Xuefeng knew. He had worked with them before. And he offers his delightful and a never-ending. What is it? What is this? The Buddha said that there are some questions that lead to awakening and some questions that are not useful. So Zui Feng here is asking one of the useful questions, not how does it work or why. Why is it this way? But a question inviting us into the moment. What is this? What is this? And all of us, in our own way, fighting through the opinion of the little self. The little self that wants so desperately to reify its existence, to find something solid to stand on. I am a person like this. And as we have talked about, this self-image in some ways doesn't matter whether it's a positive one. I am the one who is always calm. Or a negative one. I am the number one idiot in the Zendo. We all use these constructions to try to fixate the self, to try to find some ground to stand on. As we do Zazen, as we follow this way, we begin to see more and more there is not one speck of earth to stand on. We are all hurtling through space, this vast space where there is no up or down, on this little blue-green ball whirling fiercely. Circling this great star we call the sun. We practice to find out for ourself. We come to practice as the Buddha did, out of a sense that something is missing. A student once asked my teacher, "Is this it?" And my teacher said, "No." And I think what he meant is that whatever limited world you are in, whatever the contents of your mind and your heart, you are held, we are held, in a vastness that we could never be separated from. And we spend a lot of time trying to maintain this separation. The little self wants to, needs to be separate. I am here, I am this, and I am not this. Dogen said, the entire universe is the true Dharma body. There is no you without the world. And yet the Buddha, as he looked into this matter, looked into the arising of dukkha, and he found that this is how it is for us human beings. That we suffer, we are discontented, we are irritated, we are rageful. And he did not discover that suffering, that discontent is the problem to fix, but rather your discontent, your wanting more, is what has brought you here. Our wonderful reading from Da Hui, a dim and dull, a letter he wrote to one of his students who claims that he's been practicing hard, but he's never tasted an instant of this awakening. And Da Hui encourages him to be himself, and in a sense to appreciate whatever self-identity is arising. We easily want to get rid of, well, I'm not going to be this way anymore. But in Zen, we are not trying to eliminate or get rid of everything, but rather drawing a circle that is wider and wider, including the parts of ourself we appreciate and value, and including the parts of ourself that are so embarrassing, so shameful. And then, as we were saying yesterday, including even the parts that we have no idea are there. Well, I'm not like that. I've never been like that. So these stories were encouraged to enter in, to be the monk, to be the teacher. And this student who repeated the answer that Zuifang repeated the question, what is this? As Melissa said yesterday, this is a quite fine answer. He doesn't try to explain it. He doesn't go into some long philosophical discussion. He mirrors back, but Zuifang goes back to his hut, hangs his head, seeing, sensing that this student is not revealing himself. This student is hiding. We are all hiding. We might say being human is a game of hide and seek. We are hiding in plain sight. And what we long for is hiding in plain sight. As Alan Sensei said last night, nothing has ever been hidden. So how do we move into this world of right here, this world that is presenting itself? And this introduction written by Yuan Wu, the compiler, one of the compilers. As soon as there is affirmation and negation, you lose your mind in a flurry. Yes and no arise. I am going to do this. I am going to be like that. I am not going to be. Once we are in that realm, we are lost. The flurry of the mind. All of us know this very well. Our own version of flurry, worry and flurry. How was I? How will I be? How am I? So this invitation, and so how do we practice beyond right and wrong? How do we practice without labeling this as good and that as bad? And he says, but without descent into stages, there is no way of seeking. Is referring here to the stages on the path. In one way in Zen, we say there are no stages, only this moment. And yet we do grow in love and understanding in some mysterious way. As you stay with this, as you stay with practice, as you come back, round after round, as you come back, retreat, after retreat, there is some wearing away that happens, and insight arises on its own. And we do find perhaps that we can appreciate our life a little more. We find that what we learn, what we see on the cushion, we can begin to see in our life. And what we see in our life, we can begin to see on the cushion. Seeking what is right here is not about changing who we are, but about allowing ourselves to be with what is already here. And this is the fundamental shift that Dogen spoke of when he said to, when the self advances to meet the 10,000 things is delusion. And when the 10,000 things advance to meet the self is awakening. So no need to go visit some hermit in the woods. No need to attain anything. But as we're saying again and again, right in this moment, the content of your heart and your mind and your body, this is the entry point. Dharma gates are countless. They are countless right in this moment, and these conditions, your whole life has led up to this moment. We have the opportunity to practice at the very center of the universe here. You are sitting right in the heartland. And we are practicing, as we said yesterday with Yanto, we are practicing not leaving ourself, not abandoning ourself. So often we catch a glimpse of ourself and we are convinced that it is not enough, I am not enough, this could not be it. And so it's not a matter of believing this is it. You can go around saying that over and over and might be helpful, might not be helpful. But as Alan suggested last night, it is about practice. What if this is true? We say faith, doubt, and determination, the three pillars of Zen. This faith is not the believing faith. It's not to make sure you say the right things or think the right things. But faith, as we talk about it here in Zen, is the willingness to step into what we don't know. The willingness to go beyond, maybe just a teeny bit, the willingness to see what happens if we stop trying to manage our life. Right, the faith, this willingness to come when the bell rings. Doubt is this greatly valued quality in our way. Doubt of, on one hand, we might say it's a kind of a curiosity or wanting to know for yourself. But also doubt in this deeper, sometimes quite painful sense. Is this it? Is this the right place for me? Is this the right path for me? What is it? What is it? In a sense, this is the invitation of Zui Feng. What is it? What is this? And can we go beyond simply repeating Zui Feng and present the matter, present the moment itself, the truth of this moment? And then determination, this courage, this necessity to keep going. I think if there's not some necessity in your life, some urgency, not that we have it all the time, but this deep longing, this deep sense of the preciousness of life and the importance of cutting through, give rise to a kind of determination that is not about willpower and deciding this, I should do this, but some necessity, some inner necessity. And as we get in touch with and begin to align with this inner necessity, then we can live our life in some new way. We might say that our bodhisattva vow is to uncover and obey this deepest thing in us. And this deepest thing in you we can call the Dharma, we can call whatever we want it, but some current lives in you, some current burns in you, some current manifests through you, and only you. So easy, I think, for many of us to look at someone else and think, I wish I were more like her, more like him. In fact, as I sit in the Doksan room and meet each one of you, I'm quite in admiration of each one, and I think, oh, I wish I could be more like each one of you could be, because each one of you shines with this light of the Dharma. And sometimes you may know it, sometimes you may not know it, but in the end you will find yourself right where you are. And as we practice, we can begin to give ourself. There is a kind of surrender that is both giving up our project of self-improvement. It's not going to work for you. You are not going to be someone else. Sitting long and getting tired is not something we can or should try to avoid on retreat. Part of Sesshin is going beyond all of our tricks. And we go beyond our tricks not because we determine to give them up, but at some point I hope you get so tired you simply can't do it anymore. I would be a good Zen student, but I'm exhausted, so I think I'll just sit here and breathe. Oh, just the breath. Oh. Can be a letting go and easing into, surrendering into the heart of this moment. And sometimes that heart is fiery and electric and wild. And our vow is to be fiery and electric and wild, and to manifest, to allow all of this to pass through it, through us. This is not your own life. And I was saying to one of you that this, as we sit and allow ourselves to be ourselves, allow ourselves to be seen, this is our gift to the Sangha. Not to pretend that we are whoever we think we are, but to rely on something more than our plan, rely on something more than whatever strategy we have. This is called going beyond affirmation and negation. And no way of knowing if it's right to hold still or to release, to grasp or release. You can't know how to do this, but together we can find our way into this place, this field, we might say, beyond right and wrong, beyond hidden and manifest, and begin to find some ease in this world of joy and sorrow, in this world of sunshine and clouds, in this world of life and death, and not so easy to do, as the student says to Yanto. It's not so easy to bring this up, not so easy to show up with what is here in my heart. But this is the invitation for all of us to do this, again, not just for yourself, but to take this risk again and again. Whatever insight came early this morning, let that go and come back and enter in. Enter into this moment. What is this? Not what is that, or how was it? But this world offers itself to you. And can you give yourself as an offering to this world? Can we stay long enough? Can we return again and again, offering everything we have, not in some muscular histrionic way, but quietly here? We can perhaps sense the beating heart of the Sangha, the beating heart of life that could never belong to anyone, could never be lacking or in surplus. And so this is what we have the opportunity to enter into, to study and practice. And I am so grateful to be here with all of us together. Thank you. So let's make our U-shaped here in the Zendo. And move into our Dharma dialogue. So, what is it? Who are you? Yeah, Jamie.
Thank you for your talk. It's one of those that felt like it was right to me. Not sure what it is, coming and going, getting lost and returning, and used to giving. That really struck me when you said the other day about not giving yourself away. I'm very used to giving myself away and thinking that to be selfless is to do what others want. That's been my MO for a long time, and trying to do everything right that other people want, and so clearing that space for myself, and it's a precious instruction, and I'm not sure how, but have to be supported in that.
Well, and I think we all learn our own way of giving ourselves away, or trying to stack the deck in our favor. And until we see it, it simply runs the show, right? But to see whatever dodge you use, you know, some of us are very accommodating, others are very oppositional. We all have our ways. And they're all the same, in some way. And I think the gift of the teaching is just to suggest it might not have to be that way. Because it's so habitual, we just, well, this is life, and I have to please people, otherwise, you know. And we bring this awareness and hear this and think, oh, maybe I could try. And maybe, and the Zendo is such a safe and wonderful place with, we keep our eyes down, we stay still. We can take all kinds of chances in some ways right here. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, Anne.
I always thank you for your talk. I always find the hard thing is not in giving myself away, but in having faith that the world wants the gifts. Catches you every time.
It what catches you?
Oh, the fear that the world doesn't want whatever you're giving.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, really here to practice. Yeah. Right, because sometimes we do offer ourselves, and in the world, somebody says, "You know, what are you talking about?" Right? But then we habitually stop doing that, and I think it's what we were speaking of yesterday. There is a courage that it requires, because you can't know. Right, and in a sense. I feel so grateful to all my teachers and to each one of you that I'm willing to risk giving myself and hope that it might be useful, right? But I don't come in here and think, well, I'm going to preach the Dharma today and tell them what it is. It's much more, I'll try to be myself and see what arises. But Anne, it is with that same sense of let's see what happens. Yeah.
Well, and I think risk is the important word here.
Mm.
I'm remembering when David was training to be a life coach. At the beginning, the instruction was to get 100 people to turn him down, to say no. And can you imagine? You know, the pain of that, except that it was part of the training to offer yourself and then get a no back. And so often that happens in the world, doesn't it, as you're saying. But can it just be, okay then, you know, another bow. And then seeing a couple of things, I guess. Is what I offered not valuable? We could go into that story. Or is it not valuable to this person? Or do they not yet know that it's valuable? You know, so many different ways of saying that. But instead, maybe instead of making up all those reasons why somebody said no, there's just no. Okay. Ouch. Or okay. Yeah.
Well, and I didn't even get up to 10. but I did realize that I had been trained never to ask a question that no could be a response to. I'd say, well, I'm sort of doing this and you might want to, rather than would you be willing to? It turns out the world says no a lot less frequently than we might think. Thanks, Anne.
The world, what did you say?
The world says no a lot less frequently. And also, in the when we offer ourselves, it's none of our business what the result is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if I offer myself, and I'll do it as long as I can get Esther to smile, right? Then, or whomever, you know, it has to be a free will offering. And then that's, you know, that's my job, that's your job. What happens with that, because you will never know what happens with that, right? You can think, oh boy, that was a terrible talk, and then, you know, a year later somebody says, remember what you said, right? So we offer it, and in that moment we're realized.
And the no can be a yes. You know, it's just to open our perspective, you know, the no that we receive can be the world saying yes, not in the way we want them.
Yeah, Mandu.
So, I was also thinking the same thing, that you know, the world always doesn't receive us the way we want to be received, right? And so there is risk. And the risk is not only for me, and not only trying to protect myself and not showing up fully, but it's also, you know, protecting almost the world too, because it's very hard for me to see the world. Other people, you know, with broken hearts, and I don't know, that is much harder for me than just being hurt myself sometimes. So I would rather just take the risk of not showing up if it's easier for someone else.
And there's a kind of condescension in that attitude. I mean, I totally get. I won't show up as myself.
Is that a no,
Rick? I won't show up as myself because you can't handle it. Right? And I know this one very well. I don't need to say what I'm feeling because you probably will be upset. Well, you may be upset, but I'll be upset that you're upset. So, we have many reasons. And, you know, there's time, place, and circumstances. This is not a kind of self-indulgent thing. But I think we all have, each one of you has such a gift to give the world. And we've been taught that we're too much. Some of us get that. don't be like that. You better be a nice boy. And so we internalize that and we think, well, people are going to be upset, people will be hurt. If I show up as happy and as joyful as I am, people are like, well, what do you think you are? But then we're lost in it before we even take that risk. Yeah.
And even in taking that risk, I mean, speaking from personal experience, you can get a lot of no's when I just show up, you know, in a certain strong, bright way. Boy, can I get slapped down. Mm-hmm. And so so got to take that no. It's like, okay, it wasn't true when I was younger. I was just defeated by it. I just withdrew completely, terrified to show up. And now, you know, what's my choice? And I love the condescension thing because... if I'm thinking, oh, I better not say that because they can't take it, they can't hear it. It is a little bit of a fantasy projection, right? I don't know what's going on in other people's minds, so what's my choice here? And I think we're not talking about just blowing it all out of the water all the time and being, right? There's also, I really bow to consensual reality. And I think it's, and you work with a lot of people who can't bow to consensual reality. She's a psychiatrist. So there's finding the middle way. Mm-hmm. You know, how much of myself, and then choosing, and I don't think this is condescending, but making the choice, especially if I'm feeling tender, I can say this to you, but maybe that person, it's not a risk I want to take for myself. Right? And I can't know. I can never know. So we're always making mistakes. That's the other part. This is also about just one wrong move after the other. You know, Zen is a life of mistake after mistake after mistake because we keep risking. So then you're going to get feedback.
Yeah.
I didn't hear what you said. But
it is hard.
It is hard. Oh, it is hard. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David.
Thanks, David, for your talk today. The part of what you said is a grief in the middle.
Can you just speak up a little? I'm having a hard time hearing
you. Talked about that really struck me today was your discussion of great doubt. I never really felt connected to that in all these decades of practice.
Yeah.
So I feel probably I was a little, or pretty, dismissive of that idea and its importance or its reality in my life and my practice. And I can't, of course, already remember exactly what you said, but there I am, you know, again and again, coming back here and here, even right now. I can see the doubt as the driver.
Yes.
In a more visceral way, I can touch it. It's somewhere here. In a way it wasn't before.
Yeah.
So thank you.
You know, and I love what you say, doubt is the driver. In early Buddhism, and as it's continued in the modern world, doubt is considered a hindrance to practice. It's one of the hindrances. There's a bunch of them. One of them is worry and flurry, which is, I love that translation, you know, the agitation. But because we are approaching things from a different perspective, it's not a better perspective. Obviously, there are many people who love that form of Buddhism. And it, you know, it's kind of like, do this, don't do that. I get it. But that the growing, like the considering that we might be dim and dull as a problem, that we have doubt as a problem, that all the many things we talk about as problems, instead to see them as Dharma gates, and doubt especially, it's an energetic. I'm trying to remember what the original translation of that. They were popularized by Philip Kaplow as the Three Pillars of Zen, but they were originally written by a earlier Japanese or Chinese teacher named Gangfeng, and they're the, I don't know what they're called, the three something. But doubt is, the translation to doubt is just a little narrow translation of a word that means dread, really, not just doubting. And this is great doubt, and it's dread and fear, and I just love that, because that's, we all have it. To turn that into the motivator, into the driver, to turn anything that's arising into the motivator or the driver, dim, dull, whatever it is, and that's what you're discovering for yourself. And the other thing about what you're saying, David, that I so appreciate, is that we can hear this stuff over and over and over again. You know, you may have been listening to David and you don't remember a thing that he said. That's fine. That's one reason we record them, but not really. It's more that these teachings are unbelievable. And we can only find them out for ourselves. So when you gestured down and up, did you remember doing that? I was very impressed, because that's the arising of it. You know it. You know it, as we like to say, whether water is warm or cool, right? We just know it. It's nobody's asking you to sign a belief document. But it's just, what is it? What is it?
Matt.
Yeah, I guess it's more of a meta comment. I often find my mind wandering very tenacious, and I'm pulling myself back. And there's a way in which they really come alive now during the Dharma dialogue. I just feel such appreciation for the Sangha and the different perspectives that people are sharing, and also the listening that we have with each other and interactions with the teachers, and I just feel like there's something. Feeling a lot of appreciation.
Yeah, it really is a wonderful a sangha practice, and in some ways, the talks that we give are not just from us, but they are from the whole Sangha, from what's happening. And then as we each come forward with this or that, it turns the jewel just a little bit. Yeah.
And the Dharma is what arises in the talk and in the receiving of the talk. So it's not like David has the Dharma in his pocket and he's handing it out.
Right.
So that's what's arising here. And we're all part of that.
And I would say, too, that I keep thinking about a student who used to be with us who hated the Dharma dialogues, partly because the practice of Dharma dialogue disturbed him from the state that he had entered of deep practice listening to the Dharma talk. And you know, they're both practices, but they're really different. Mm. Listening to the Dharma talk, it's just like watching your breath. You know, you hear some, you get lost, the mind wanders, makes associations, and then, oh, what is he saying now? Over and over and over again. In the Dharma dialogue, it's a more difficult practice, like walking meditation is more difficult than sitting, because there's more stuff going on. And so to follow the Dharma contribution of each person, notice what touches you, what does it, etc. You know, it's more advanced practice. I'm not putting down that other person, because I really get his particular love for that state of getting lost in words that weren't clear to him. Right? He really valued that. And he just couldn't make the leap, which I think is one reason he had to leave this Sangha, because we are not the be-all and end-all. There are places where this doesn't happen. In fact, most places it doesn't happen. But I also really appreciate it. I love this form we've created together. Thank you.
Rich?
So, I don't know why, but this... one of the readings keeps coming up where it says, we love everything and everything loves us, which always catches me. Really? I don't have to know that, but I don't know, it just...
Yeah, it's a wonderful one, and it is about this, we're talking about some kind of reciprocal thing that's going on here, that it doesn't appear reciprocal. It feels like I'm here and that's out there.
Right.
But this dependent co-arising, this early Buddhist teaching of the self and the world create each other. You know, I often speak of this allowing ourselves to be seen, right? Which is a very subtle attitude. And, you know, Anne, we were talking about risk here. And this... this practice, I think, can show us that, you know, risk a little, get a little, risk a lot, get a lot, risk everything, get everything. The jeweled mirror samadhi, the jeweled mirror of life, we are participating in it in a way that we cannot comprehend. Right, so to see the donkey sees the well and the well sees the donkey. Right. Like how wonderful. And then how could anyone not be accepted? You know, I can sit here and think, well, people don't really accept me, they don't know me, you know, or whatever. But breathe in, breathe out, no separation. Yeah.
In this way, generosity to the world is generosity to yourself.
Anyone who hasn't spoken in our Dharma dialogue, willing to raise your hand? And
you mean today or during
the week? Either way. Yeah, you raised your hand.
Well, in that case, I was nodding out during the talk, and for some reason, knock on wood, I rarely do that, you know. And I would come in and out and hear it and try and get myself. And at some point, you said something like making friends with or allowing whatever state.
Mm.
And to allow the sleepiness is really tricky because you're not even there to allow in a way. I felt like I had to use a certain amount of will just to eat. But
just what?
You some had willpower.
Yeah, but then you said something else.
To stay here.
To stay here.
Yeah.
Listen.
Yeah.
And then I would feel it. But boy, when the dialogue started, whoom. There's something about the unified organism that you talk about being in retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where that all of us together just, the comedy.
Well, and it does take some willpower, some intention, right? We say willpower is a weak force, but we have to make decisions and choose, and this choosing, you're choosing to bring yourself back again and again. Yeah.
And there's another part of us when you say, when you're sleepy, you have to make an effort, there's another way of practicing that's more open and allowing, and that is in our zazen and in listening to Dharma talks, if sleepiness arises. I'm sure you're the only person who has had this experience at this retreat. No, I'm kidding, right? Because lots of us are tired, and lots of us may have spaced out during the talk. Even David. So can we allow that? Who's the one who's allowing and not allowing?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Is there somebody in there, some little robot in your brain running switches like in those cartoon movies? I don't think so. Yeah. So when we're overtaken by something, could be sleepiness, could be anger, could be fear, could be doubt, right, as we're speaking about it, to just realize that it's like the weather, like that reading we did. So this is what's happening. Now it's raining, now it's sunny. We're not in control. And there's a certain point we reach, and I've said this to at least one of you, that Sasheen is designed to reveal how powerless we are over our own inner states.
Mm-hmm.
But the invitation is this inner state. And that really includes sleepiness and spaciness, could be the Dharma gate that's required for awakening. But because we keep dismissing it and cutting it away from us, we miss it. Yeah. So other ways to be, right? This is quite radical.
Yeah, thanks. Jenny.
It came to mind something a music teacher told me once, that you play like you're afraid someone's going to hear you. And then a little bit before it ever came on, those kids are always banging on that piano. So kind of, the world not letting, right? You're ashamed of what you are. Because be ashamed of what you are.
We're taught. I mean, we learn what we need to learn to survive and to get by. And so there's some kind of retraining going on here and experimenting. What if I do play my own horn? What's it like for me to do that? And no one else can give you permission to do that. We might be curious. What is that song?
Yeah. You know, Jenny, if you could go hypothetically back into time and meet me 20 years prior and painted this scenario, it would be a nightmare. This is a horrible situation for me 20 years prior. So, but what happened in between? There was never a switch that went off. There was never an intention. It was just showing up and opening, and something over 20 years happened. I don't know why, but here I am.
I'm going to say for me, 50. but, you know, I keep thinking about, I took a class from a very dynamic, and she was at the time a famous Scottish folk singer named Jean Redpath. Mm-hmm. I was her teacher assistant at college. And she would tell this story, trying to get us, you know, if you've heard Scottish folk music, it's very strong, right? And the vocal stuff is, like, powerful. And she was not a withdrawn person. But when she was a small child in music class, the teacher went around the room and patted people's heads and said, "You just move your mouth. You just move your mouth." And they told her that. "You just move your mouth." How did she develop into this dynamic folk singer? You know, gillions of albums and all kinds of stuff known all over the world. How did that happen? But I think that's what Michael's pointing to here. This, it's not an automatic switch that happens. And there is this working with, you know, believing what other people have told you, and then overdoing it, and then finding the way.
And last one, Sabrina, did you?
So I find myself tripping over the term Dharma Gate. Because how do I enter a Dharma Gate when I'm already in a Dharma Gate?
Nice.
I don't even, that just like blew my mind.
You know, that's the paradox of practice. Why do we practice if we're already awake? And so this entering Dharma Gate, we might say entering into the moment, that many of us live at a slight distance or a great distance from the moment, right? Lost in our opinion. So entry is about maybe moving up close, right? Dancing with, engaging, because usually we're looking away. We're looking toward, oh, it'll be better tomorrow, da 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 da. So there is. Although right, there's no place to enter, no place to stand, already manifest. And I think maybe going back to what Tom was saying too, there's something that's required, right? There is something that's impossible to, well, how do I do that? But some intention to enter, I think.
What I'm hearing, maybe, tell me if I'm off here, is how can I enter something that I'm already in the middle of? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah. And that's the great question of Zen, you know, that we're all touching into, in a way. If I'm already a Buddha, why don't I know that? And this is a Buddha? Are you kidding me? No, that gold guy on the altar, he's a Buddha. It's this shift in perspective. So it's probably a poor metaphor to have talk about a gate to enter, and you know, dismiss. You can dismiss it. I've been very encouraged by that term myself, just different approach to it, because I sometimes feel myself hesitating to really be present, to go through the gate, and especially if the gate is stuff I don't like about myself or about the world. I can feel myself turning away in disgust or horror or fear or whatever it is. So for me, it's a very sweet metaphor. It doesn't have to be for you. I really appreciate what you said. And I always think of that poem by Rumi. There's a line, you know, Rumi, where he doesn't use the word Dharma Gate, but he talks about people passing back and forth through the doorway where the two worlds touch, right? And this is the world of awakening and the world of delusion, maybe that's what he's talking about. And then he says, the door is open. What are you doing staying on one side or the other? And there's this constant flow, don't we know that? Sometimes I'm just like, oh, everything, yes. And other times, oh, no. And it just that's going through the doorway where the door sill where the two worlds touch. These are metaphors, right? But there's, see, we have to, going back to what Rich said, you know, sometimes something will catch us, like that line about if the world loves you, what? I'm sorry, but no. And then just respect the touching of it, like respect that feeling of what? The stuck place, the, thinking about Dharma gates or being loved by the world, you know. It's wonderful though, and it's true, and they're true in some way. And years from now, these lines will enter again, and we'll go, oh, I knew this the whole time, but I didn't know that I knew it.
Thank you. Please restore the zendo. Thank you.